What if we could reimagine the traditional notion of a high flyer? Hey friends, welcome back. Welcome to the High Flyers podcast, where we do reimagine a high flyer, showcase relatable role models and their journey in work and life, including their sunrise, magic moments, hustle, and much, much more to help you achieve your potential, become your best self, and continue to be 1% better every single day. I'm your host, Vidit Agarwal, and let's get started.
And so, good storytelling makes you, the audience, lean in and care, because it gives you some reason to connect or reason to believe. And so, the opposite, I guess, is bad storytelling, where it's very myopic, very factual, very technical, and oftentimes early stage, especially if it is a really technical product.
That's Kate Dinon, and in this episode, explore your curiosity about PR, communications, and investment to scale startups. Learn about how Kate had a break into PR and communications, and then building out her own firm, Character and Distinction, based in Melbourne with a roster of recognizable brands. I asked Kate about the first few months of starting the firm, client relationships, bad storytelling, and displaying culture in the office space, and you hear about Kate's foray into supporting startups through mentoring and investment via Protagonist Capital, what she's looking for in founders, and don't miss out on a special rapid fire round with your community questions. Please enjoy. Kate Dinon, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I'm pumped to have you on. You've been so kind in all your help prior to this episode, so I think this is a good way for me to try and give back to you in a small way. So maybe a good place to start, Kate, is to give some foundation to the listener. So can you help us understand where you were born and where you live now?
Yeah, I was born in Perth in Subiaco. I was actually born 3 months premature. And at the time, I think I was the youngest baby to survive at being born that early. So, yeah, King Edward Memorial did a very good job, and I think I was on the front page of the paper, or like very close to the front page, because it was a bit of a miracle. So maybe there was a bit of foreshadowing of what I might be doing 40 years later, right back then.
And now you're Melbourne-based?
Now I live in Melbourne, yep, with my husband and two daughters.
And let's talk about your work now. I mean, that's the point of today's conversation. Maybe a good place to touch on that is, when did you first hear about the world of PR and communications and branding? Do you remember that moment?
I do, because I started my career actually working in HR, and I worked in HR for about 7 or 8 years, moved overseas and was working at a listed company as the head of HR. And the CEO at the time said to me, the head of corporate communications role is open. I think you'd be really good at it. Would you like to give it a go? And I honestly thought that all they did in comms was make posters for internal comms and deal with investors from an investor relations perspective. And I thought that sounded pretty boring, but he was convinced that I'd be really good at it and said, give it a go. And if you don't like it, you know, after 12 months, if you don't like it, you can do something else. So I thought, well, how can I say no to that? And I absolutely loved it from the first minute in the job.
If we fast forward a bit, you went from obviously building experience to then starting your own firm. And I understand you started off under your own name, under Kate Dinon, yeah. And now it's under Character and Distinction. Was there a conscious decision to do that? Because a lot of people stay in PR as a employee and are happy with that, but you've taken on an added responsibility of creating a firm around it.
Yeah. So starting my own, going out on my own really felt like the right thing to do. So I was living in Switzerland, that job I was in, the head of corporate comms moved to Switzerland. So I was living there. I met my now husband there. And after we got married, we decided to move back to Australia, have kids. And I just thought when we got back to Australia, I don't actually want to work for anyone else now. I want to just be my own boss so that I can, you know, we can have kids, we can do things our way. My husband has a pretty busy job. So I thought it'd be really good if I had the flexibility. Just thinking, oh, yeah, it'll be so flexible running my own business and being my own boss, which was not correct. And so started out on my own, just had a few clients, you know, here and there. And then, and therefore, Kate Dinon PR was what it was called, but it was just me. And then got a really big opportunity to work with a big global brand, but needed some extra help to help me do it. And so was introduced to this amazing person, Sarah Green, who is now my business partner. And when Sarah joined, I just thought, her email address was sarah@katedinon.com. And I just thought, that is so wrong. It just didn't, you know, just felt wrong in every way. And so we formalized our partnership more and gave the business a name, and that's how it started.
So cool. And one of the things I love talking about in that comment there is the first 3 months, or the first 3 or 4 months. Do you, if you recall, and I know it was back in 2017, if I'm not mistaken, do you recall what that was like early on? Because that's probably a good kind of transition also into talking more about PR, because I feel like it's one of those areas that people assume they know what the work is, but don't actually know what goes on. And then I'll ask listeners to watch some of your YouTube videos where you've actually talked about what is and what isn't PR and comms. But if we think about, yeah, those early days in 2017, what were those first few months like, and what were some of the biggest sort of unknowns?
Gosh, I'm such a look forward person that it's really hard for me to go back. But if I think about that time, I had a young child. We probably had, I think it was probably still just Sarah and I, and then the amazing Melia Rayner joined us. And we probably had 5 or 6 clients. So what was it like? We didn't really have any processes. We didn't really have any systems. We were just doing the work and doing good work for the clients and focused on that. So I think how it felt was probably really exciting, and it still does feel really exciting. I try and minimize all of the noise of running a business so I can focus on the work as much as possible. And so have got really great advisors around the business that we've had for a long time. So tax, legal, insurance broker. And so I spent a lot of time getting references and getting all of those pieces in place from the beginning so that everything was set up so we could focus on the work.
Probably an aspect of that that I'd love to double click on is talking to a number of people that know you leading up to this. They mentioned your relationship building ability, and I've seen that firsthand. You're really authentic about it, and you do it in a really genuine way. I'd imagine that's a big part, particularly starting a business early on, but in any facet of business. Did you find that was something you put a lot of focus on early on, particularly as you said, you came from Switzerland and you're building a network in Australia?
Totally. I was out of the country, out of Australia for, well, so I had a major career change. So the network I had from Australia when I came back was completely different. You know, it wasn't in a one way useful, which sounds like a terrible way to talk about your network, but it was just a completely different network of people. And so coming back, yeah, absolutely, I had to start from practically zero. Honestly, the way I approached it then and still approach it now is just, I'm a very curious person. I genuinely like to help people, and I love learning and having ideas and giving people ideas and hearing people's ideas. So it has always been very much about just wanting to meet as many interesting people as I can. And if I can help someone in a 30-minute coffee or a 15-minute chat, I love to do that. And so I was very intentional. I must have had, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 coffee meetings a week for 2 or 3 years. Said yes to everything, just jumped in, helped where I could, got involved with all sorts of projects, and did, you know, scope creep is the biggest thing for me to manage, because I just want to dive in and help as much as I possibly can. I like to see things, like I like to make things happen in the world. And so whenever there's someone with a great idea that needs help, I'm like the first person to put my hand up and say, how can I help you? So I think it's a mix of, it's just my personality. And then, but I was very intentional, knowing that if I want to build my life here in Melbourne, in Australia, I want to have a great network of people that I trust and that trust me, because, you know, as you probably know, you would definitely know that if you've got those great relationships, you can make things happen really quickly. And that's very valuable for clients as well.
I like that point you mentioned on trust and clients. That was going to be my next question, is how do you build, sort of, if you demystify some of the work you do, how do you build client relationships? And I know you mentioned some of the work you do is either on referral or through a warm intro, but what does that look like on an operational basis? Like, does a client reach out to you and go, hey, Kate, or one of your team members, and goes, hey, we want to explore working together? How does that work in your world, like a client relationship, particularly a new client relationship?
100% referral, I would say, is how we get new clients, or how new clients come into our world. And that has always been my focus as well with the team, is that what I think we're so lucky to have the clients that we have, and that their loyalty to us is unbelievable. We've still got clients that we've had since day one. And so our goal, our focus is always on the clients we have, not the clients we might get one day. And so we don't go into pitches. We don't go into those open processes where 10 firms get invited to pitch and it gets narrowed down to three, and you do hours and hours and hours of work, and all your best ideas and all your creativity goes there. And then what happens to the clients that you've got? So we're very focused on delivering great work for the clients that we've got. And because we do that, the clients we've got really like us, and they tell other people about us, and then other people want to work with us. And that's just how it's always been. So we are in a pretty fortunate position, I guess, in that we don't really have capacity to take on new clients. It's quite rare that we can take on new clients, because I've been very intentional too in not growing. We could be a much bigger firm based on the amount of work that comes our way that we say no to. So that's been a really intentional decision as well.
Can you talk to what that process looks like early on in terms of education building with a client? Like, there might be listeners, whether they're startup founders or senior leaders in a company, that perhaps are looking for a warm intro to you and are going, actually, but I don't know what to ask Kate, or I don't know what character I'm going to look for. Yeah. What does that first conversation or the first two conversations look like? Like, how do you build education about what you do and what they do?
Yeah. So the first meeting for me is always just, I just want to learn as much as possible about the business and what goals they're really looking to achieve. So where are they at? What's top of mind for them? What does success look like? And then I can assess two things. Is PR actually what they need right now? Is it a good time and a good use of their resources? And also, are they resourced internally well enough to take advantage of the investment that they're making? And then secondly, if they are we the right firm? Or should they be talking to someone else? And if they should be talking to someone else, I'm the first person to tell them, I think you should be talking to this person, or this person, because they're going to do a better job than we will, given your needs. So I really just try to understand, the things that PR can achieve, is that what the business really needs right now? And those things, really, if you want me to go on and explain what the common things PR can help with, is really usually it's around attracting investment. We work with a lot of early stage companies that are really looking to establish their own corporate narrative or their investment thesis for later rounds, whether it's to help them hire employees and attract talent, whether it's customer acquisition, whether it's awareness, if it's an issue or a cause, if there's some market education needed, if there's some policy change needed. So they're the sort of levers that we have where we can actually help achieve results. And so I try and just assess, is this a good thing for them to be doing right now, and are we a good fit? And if so, then I have a million questions, and just try to understand, do we like each other as well? Do we want to work together?
And I know you talk about, or you've mentioned in our call previously about storytelling and helping founders with that and obviously helping businesses with that. What have you found that's bad storytelling? I know that's a blunt question, but what have you found that's bad storytelling? Because again, me being a media platform in a way, it can be really hard sometimes to see that authenticity, like people are trying to sell something or using it as a sales process sometimes, particularly when they're an early stage business and they're trying to get exposure and they can't get on the big newspaper platforms, but they're using a more personalized platform. What to you is a no-no? Like, what do you advise founders or companies going, no, don't do that. That's actually going to be worse for your brand.
Yeah, good question. So the bad storytelling is usually it's either just way too technical. So it's way too much about the what. And I hate to quote Simon Sinek because that's pretty cliche, but his start with why is a really good basic model. And he sort of says that people don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it. And I fundamentally believe that. And people connect, you know, with a why, a purpose or a vision behind a business before they connect with your platform. And so good storytelling makes you, the audience, lean in and care because it gives you some reason to connect or reason to believe. And so the opposite, I guess, is bad storytelling where it's very myopic, very factual, very technical, and oftentimes early stage, especially if it is a really technical product, that's where the founders start out, and that's okay. I think everyone starts out there, and most people don't think their founding story is interesting enough, and so really just try and work with founders or executives to help them tell the story in a way that is authentic to them and that connects with the audience that they want to connect with.
And I understand you have 12 to 15 brands at one time across sectors. And if people go to your website, they can see the breadth of sectors you have. What would you say are some of the sectors that are low maintenance versus high maintenance? But if you look at like a Mercedes-Benz versus a Deliveroo versus an Upbank, how do you differentiate from a resource perspective or attention perspective, these clients or sectors need a lot of time versus the ones that are well-oiled, they just need a bit of support, but they're all good?
Oh, it's not possible. It's not a sector thing. I think, well, first thing, every client gets the same amount of time, let's say. We don't bill by hours or we don't report on hours or quote on hours, but ultimately, yes, of course, you know, we are selling our time to our clients. But more than that, we're selling outcomes, the result of many years of relationships, creativity, connections that we can make. So I think more about it in terms of how do we allocate our time internally as a team to get the most value for our clients? So we have internal sessions for each client where we come up with concepts for each client that we get the whole team's input on. And then the execution, yes, is very time task driven, but the real value is in the strategy and the creativity. So every kind of client gets the same, but in terms of sectors that are just more active from a media perspective, for sure that's anything where there's a lot of policy political crossover or where the industry is very topical at any point in time means there's a lot more reactive. So there's a lot more inbound media requests. There's a lot more potentially issues management. So at that point, you know, that sometimes tips over into what we call a crisis response where we actually have to dedicate more physical time because of just the amount of inbound that's coming in. So I don't know if I answered your question.
No, I think I asked you a tricky question, so I appreciate you sharing that. I think one of the other things, Kate, also is I know reading your content on LinkedIn and social media, you're very big on keeping up to date with global trends. And I saw a LinkedIn post the other day where you brought, I forget the lady's name, but someone quite prominent to Sydney to talk at the Vivid Sydney event in June. And you mentioned the fact that you sent a cold message in the back of her newsletter. I wonder who are some of the newspaper outlets or newsletters or agencies that you learn from and that you follow and you're inspired by?
Great question. So yes, we're bringing this incredible brand strategist named Anna Angelic from New York to Sydney for Vivid, which I'm very excited about. And I've been, this is the, I think the eighth time I've been involved in bringing a speaker to Australia for Vivid, and it's something that I just do because it's a passion. And because one of our values is around being global citizens, curious global citizens. And so we never want to be parochial. We never want to stay too boxed in. But I looked, because I knew you were going to ask me something about on this track, I looked at Unroll Me to see how many newsletter subscriptions I currently have, and I have 1,637 newsletters that I subscribe to. So, and that's, and then I have, you know, I still get a lot of magazines and obviously all the online stuff. I read academic journals. So I subscribe to literally thousands of things, and I take and I read really, really widely. So I think, and I really go through like phases where I'm obsessed with one thing and I have to read every word, and then I'm like, oh yeah, I'll just scan that from time to time. So right now I really, really like listening to the All In podcast, because I really like the analysis and the debate, and I guess just hearing friends having conversations that you feel like are conversations that they have in their friendship group that you just get to listen into. So I like that. I learn a lot from that, particularly on the investing side. And then, oh gosh, there's really honestly hundreds, but I guess just my main source of information every day is Twitter. And I don't know how many links I would click in Twitter every day. 15 probably.
Last question before we go into some of your investment journey and talk about a few other topics is, when I googled your name, I saw there was an article about your character and distinction office, and I have heard on good source that office is quite a nice office and you've done it with a lot of attention and detail. I wonder if you can touch on that about your own, like one thing I'm always curious about when you run a agency like that is, how do you look at design and architecture? Like I, over the last few years, I've become really interested in that, and I am just a nerd where I nerd out on colors and graphics and fonts. And I imagine you probably do that as well, and that'd be something you're really passionate about. But can you talk to, like, it's a broad question, but can you talk to that office design? Like, was that something that was important to you and that was something as part of your culture?
Very, very important for a number of reasons. I think what we advise brands all the time about how they show up in the world, and we think every brand touch point should be considered and should tell your brand story. And so for me, being able to physically bring our brand, Character and Distinctions brand, to life in a physical space was really exciting for me. So it's a mix of, you know, there's a lot of gum tree sourcing going on. I have like a million gum tree alerts for different like, kind of random and rare furniture pieces. I'm a massive furniture design and art nerd, so could definitely nerd out with you on that. So there's a lot of Gumtree in there. We had a client at the time, Tint, that makes paint, and so they did a custom color for one of our rooms that we matched to an artwork that we had commissioned, because every 18 months we commission an artist to make an artwork for the brand, and we then integrate that across our brand and change our window. And so we've gone all in on that, and it's important to me because yes, it's a brand touch point. It's a way that clients get to experience our brand and friends, but more importantly for the team to have a space. The brief when designing the office was really that it's an office, yes, but it should feel residential. It should feel like a place you just want to hang out, be creative, talk, relax, read, you know, have meetings. So it's really for the team so that they have a place that they're really proud of and that they like being in. And that was all pre-COVID. And so I think it's even more important now than it was before.
Super cool. I mean, for listeners, if you're interested in working with Kate, maybe that's one way, is go to the office and check out the cool decorations and setup you have there in Melbourne.
Come and check it out. You should come and check it out too.
I'd love to. Yeah, next time in Melbourne, I definitely will drop by. Now, if you talk about angel investing and your work in that space, I again understand that you've been doing it in a private capacity for a number of years, but more recently you've formalized it. What led you into angel investing? Do you remember the first time you did it?
Yeah. Yes. My really good friend, Gavin Appel, who I met at one of those random, it wasn't a coffee meeting, but it was a City of Melbourne convened workshop where they wanted to get lots of people's input, which was really amazing. This amazing woman, Bonnie Shaw, who used to be at City of Melbourne, ran it, and I got to sit next to Gavin, and Gavin and I were just like chatting the whole time. We've become really, really, really good friends since then, and he's been probably like one of my biggest supporters in, because I had, of course, you know, all the usual imposter syndrome around, well, why would I be useful to a founder? What do I have to bring to the table? Are these skills really as valuable as legal skills or operational skills or what have you? And so Gavin very kindly, I guess, referred me into the StartMate world probably five years ago, and I became a StartMate mentor back then. So I think it was 2018, I think. And so got involved that way. So very much just started as a mentor and worked with startups through the accelerator program. And one of them that I met in one of the interview processes before the accelerator program, we had a 30-minute meeting. It was fantastic. I loved the founders, two brothers. And afterwards they actually came to me and said, hey, we'd love you to be an advisor. We'll give you some equity for some time. And I thought, oh, wow, that's amazing. And yes, and I still work with them. So it wasn't an investment of my money, the first one, but it was an investment of my time. And so that was the first. And then, yeah, over the following years, my husband and I have made a few other angel investments as well. And it's just fantastic.
Yeah, I couldn't speak highly of the StartMate community. I've recently joined the First Believers program, and I'm sort of in my early days of making my foray into angel investing, and it's fascinating just the community and the passion that's there. On that point, Kate, I reached out to Nick, our mutual friend, and he gave me a couple of questions. One of the things he's curious to ask is, what are you looking for in the deals that you're doing? Have you got a specific sector or a specific kind of person you're looking for that you want to support?
Yes, great question. I started out thinking, oh, it can just be anyone that needs, you know, that has a great story to tell, that has a global, you know, is global from day one. And then I started getting a lot of inbound from people, and I thought, well, I would never do that. Oh, no, I would never do that. And I thought, well, that's not fair, because I'm not telling people what we are looking for. And so I think the way I have come to break it down quickly is consumer facing products and brands, and enterprise tech, particularly anything focused around work. And I think that's because of two things. One is where our passion is, as a team, and my passion, and it's where our best expert, where we can help the most. So where can we be more valuable as advisors than others? And I think that's where we've got the most experience, runs on the board, connections, networks.
And would you have any steer for listeners today, or in general people that want to reach out to you, future founders or current founders? Because I think one of the perceptions I get this sometimes is, because I worked in consumer and retail for a number of years, people assume that's the only sector I want to invest in. And they go, oh, would you want to invest in SaaS? I'd go, yeah, if the company's the right company and the founders are right, of course I'd be open to it. And I imagine maybe there's an element of that with your work, where people go, if it's not a PR or comms aligned startup, Kate can't support us. Do you want to maybe shed some light on that?
Yeah, I think it doesn't have to be aligned to PR and comms at all. I think that founders with a really big vision is what I get really excited about. So a big vision and a very positive attitude, which most founders just have by nature of the fact that they've gone and done this crazy thing. It really doesn't, it really doesn't matter if it's consumer facing or it's enterprise facing, which is most businesses in one way or another, and you feel like you need, you feel like your story can be a real driver of your success if you get it right, then I'd love to talk. And I've met some absolutely incredible founders, pre-product, which is what I, which is also where we like to be, pre-product or really, really early revenue.
And I also want to talk about your naming convention. That's something I absolutely love about everything you do. Your naming conventions with character and distinction, then with protagonist is awesome. Like, it gets me thinking twice. You're like, oh, what led to that naming convention? Can you share, like, it's a random question, but I want to ask this. Like, what led to the name Protagonist Capital? Like, it makes sense when you Google the actual meaning of it, but how did you come up with that name, and does that have a certain relevance with the work you do?
Yeah, I love naming. It's one of my favorite things to do. So if anyone out there is, like, you know, noodling on names, feel free to send me a little brief and I'll shoot you back some ideas, because I genuinely just enjoy doing it. So the way I thought about Protagonist particularly was I wanted it to feel like a cousin of character, not a sister, if that makes sense, because the two companies aren't legally connected. Mm. They're connected in some way, but they're not, they're not legally connected. So for me, early stage investing is all about the founder, and therefore, and I think the founder is a protagonist. I mean, they're the ultimate protagonist. They take the story forward. The story is about them, at least in the early days. So I won't bore you with my process, but there is a process. I think I came out with four or five names that I really liked. The other one was First Mate. I really liked First Mate, but someone had used that in a relatively tangential area, so I wanted to stay away from that. So I whittled it down to four, and then I shared it with the team, and then the team all chose Protagonist as their favorite.
Love it. I've actually got a running list of names that I pick up from TV shows, newsletters, conversations, and constantly adding to it, going, well, that name's really cool. That name's really cool for a future project or a business. So completely agree with you on that. So we've got a few minutes left, Kate. So I'd love to do a quick rapid fire round. And I've got some questions from the community that people want to ask you as well. The first one, this one's from Nick again. He goes, ask Kate about her inspiration she gets from the friendship with Kate Morris. Is there anyone else that inspires you?
Oh, I love Kate Morris. She's such a good person. So I get a lot of inspiration from Kate. She's just a genuinely wonderful person, great leader, very smart, great mum, just a great person. So, yes, love her dearly. Get a lot of inspiration from her. She's just got this incredible attitude to life, which I like to think I share, but I also, like, she's just a bit extra than me. So I'm like, yeah, go Kate. Who else inspires me? Well, Nick inspires me a lot. I love how thoughtful he is about everything and how intentional he is about everything. Another person that really inspires me a lot all the time is Didier Elzinger, the founder of CultureAmp, co-founder of CultureAmp. Just the way he listens to everyone in meetings is something I really take a lot from. I like to jump in. I like to solve problems quickly. I like to move on, get it done. Didier is very good at sitting back, listening to everyone, hearing what everyone has to say, then sharing his perspective. And I try really hard to do that more, and I get that from him.
I understand you live a city and a beach life, and it sounds like it's an amazing work-life balance. Would you recommend that?
Work-life balance? Yeah, I would recommend that. No, yes, I would. When you work at a fast pace and, you know, 24/7, having a place that you can go, and I know I'm very privileged that I have a place I can, like a physical place that I can go, is just a place where it's just the family and nothing else, and I'm pretty strict about that. So, yes, it's great to have a physical switch off on weekends.
And our other mutual friend, Ed McManus, he says, Kate, you're highly productive despite drinking from the fire hose. What are your tricks?
I think I honestly just think that's a natural skill. I have a pretty short attention span. I like to take in a lot of information. I I'm a big believer, like, I don't read emails twice or texts twice. I don't sit on things. So I think that's my trick, is that answer it straight away. 9 times out of 10 you can. And momentum is everything to me. Momentum creates more momentum. So I'm a big believer in just pushing on with the idea, even if it's not fully formed. Obviously, there's some examples where you can't do that, but for the most part, momentum is my productivity hack, honestly.
And last one, I've pulled this out from my longer form episodes, is what's one thing you would like to learn in the next 6 months?
I'd like to learn how to say no better to founders when we've decided not to invest, because it feels to me like something that if I can get that right, I can be helpful. I can continue to build our reputation as investors, and I can get better at saying no, which I'm just not good at by nature. So I need to find better ways to say no. Nick Crocker's been very helpful on that front, but if anyone else has any tips for me, I would love to hear them.
Yeah, there's actually a few by Jason Calacanis from the All In podcast. He shared a few on his own podcast, even in his book, that I think I have written down somewhere. I can flick it across. But I think also there, I always wonder culturally how that works, because I think the US is a bit more direct, if I can use that, whereas I think Australia is a bit more, particularly where the ecosystem is, I think relationships are critical, whereas in the US it's so mature and someone like Jason probably gets enough attention anyway, whereas if he says no to someone, it probably doesn't affect his own PR, I'd imagine. So
I don't know the balance. I honestly think if you can say no in the right way, it builds the relationship. It makes the relationship even stronger. And that's what I'm really trying to lean into and learn how to do.
Well, that's the finish line, Kate. I'd love to talk for hours and I've got so many questions. So maybe we can do a follow-up episode in the future. But so excited to do this and really excited for what's ahead for you.
Thank you so much. I love what you're doing and thank you for having me be part of it.
I hope you've taken away some valuable insights from this conversation to apply to your lives and continue to be 1% better every day. And stay tuned for the next episode in this Curiosity series, where we take you inside another topic, company, or industry.